Section 7 of The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by Howard Phillips Lovecraft. Read by Martin Rato. Carter's pursuit of the yak became now a flight from an unseen thing, for though he dared not glance over his shoulder, he felt that the presence behind him could be nothing wholesome or mentionable. His yak must have heard or felt it first, and he did not like to ask himself whether it had followed him from the haunts of men or had floundered up out of that black quarry pit. Meanwhile, the cliffs had been left behind, so that the oncoming night fell over a great waste of sand and spectral rocks wherein all paths were lost. He could not see the hoofprints of his yak, but always from behind him there came that detestable clopping, mingled now and then with what he fancied were titanic flappings and whirrings. That he was losing ground seemed unhappily clear to him, and he knew he was hopelessly lost in this broken and blasted desert of meaningless rocks and untraveled sands. Only those remote and impassable peaks on the right gave him any sense of direction, and even they were less clear as the gray twilight waned and the sickly phosphorescence of the clouds took its place. Then, dim and misty in the darkling north before him, he glimpsed a terrible thing. He had thought it for some moments a range of black mountains, but now he saw it was something more. The phosphorescence of the brooding clouds showed it plainly, and even silhouetted parts of it as vapors glowed behind. How distant it was he could not tell, but it must have been very far. It was thousands of feet high, stretching in a great concave arc from the gray impassable peaks to the unimagined westward spaces, and had once indeed been a ridge of mighty onyx hills. But now these hills were hills no more, for some hand greater than man's had touched them. Silent they squatted there atop the world like wolves or ghouls, crowned with clouds and mists and guarding the secrets of the north forever. All in a great half-circle they squatted, those dog-like mountains carven into monstrous watching statues, and their right hands were raised in menace against mankind. It was only the flickering light of the clouds that made their mitered double heads seem to move, but as Carter stumbled on, he saw arise from their shadowy caps great forms whose motions were no delusion. Winged and whirring, those forms grew larger each moment, and the traveler knew his stumbling was at an end. They were not any birds or bats known elsewhere on earth or in dreamland, for they were larger than elephants and had heads like horses. Carter knew that they must be the Shantag birds of ill rumor, and wondered no more what evil guardians and nameless sentinels made men avoid the boreal rock desert. And as he stopped in final resignation, he dared at last to look behind him, where indeed was trotting the squat, slant-eyed trader of evil legend, grinning astride a lean yak, and leading on a noxious horde of leering Shantaks, to whose wings still clung the rime and nitre of the nether pits. Trapped though he was by fabulous and hippocephalic winged nightmares that pressed around in great unholy circles, Randolph Carter did not lose consciousness. Lofty and horrible, those titan gargoyles towered above him, while the slant-eyed merchant leaped down from his yak and stood grinning before the captive. Then the man motioned Carter to mount one of the repugnant Shantaks, helping him up as his judgment struggled with his loathing. It was hard work ascending, for the Shantak bird had scales instead of feathers, and those scales are very slippery. Once he was seated, the slant-eyed man hopped up behind him, leaving the lean yak to be led away northward toward the ring of carven mountains by one of the incredible bird colossi. There now followed a hideous whirl through frigid space, endlessly up and eastward toward the gaunt gray flanks of those impassable mountains beyond which Lang was set to be. Far above the clouds they flew, till at last there lay beneath them those fabled summits which the folk of Inquinoc have never seen, and which lie always in high vortices of gleaming mist. Carter beheld them very plainly as they passed below, and saw upon their topmost peaks strange caves, which made him think of those on Inkranik. But he did not question his captor about these things when he noticed that both the man and the horse-headed Shantak appeared oddly fearful of them, hurrying past nervously and showing great tension until they were left far in the rear. The Shantak now flew lower, revealing beneath the canopy of cloud a gray, barren plain, whereon at great distance shone little feeble fires. As they descended, there appeared at intervals lone huts of granite and bleak stone villages, whose tiny windows glowed with pallid light. And there came from those huts and villages a shrill droning of pipes and a nauseous rattle of crotala, which proved at once that Inquinoc's people are right in their geographic rumors. For travelers have heard such sounds before, and know that they float only from the cold desert plateau which healthy folk never visit. That haunted place of evil and mystery, which is Lang. Around the feeble fires dark forms were dancing, and Carter was curious as to what manner of beings they might be, for no healthy folk have ever been to Lang, and the place is known only by its fires and stone huts as seen from afar. Very slowly and awkwardly did those forms leap, and with an insane twisting and bending not good to behold, so that Carter did not wonder at the monstrous evil imputed to them by vague legend, or the fear in which all dreamland holds their abhorrent frozen plateau. As the Shantak flew lower, the repulsiveness of the dancers became tinged with a certain hellish familiarity, and the prisoner kept straining his eyes and racking his memory for clues to where he'd seen such creatures before. They leaped as though they had hooves instead of feet, and seemed to wear a sort of wig or headpiece with small horns. Of other clothing they had none, but most of them were quite furry. Behind they had dwarfish tails, and when they glanced upward he saw the excessive width of their mouths. Then he knew what they were, and that they did not wear any wigs or headpieces after all, for the cryptic folk of Lang were of one race with the uncomfortable merchants of the black galleys that traded rubies at Dilathleen, those not quite human merchants who are the slaves of the monstrous moon things. They were indeed the same dark folk who had shank-hide Carter on their noisome galley so long ago, and whose kith he had seen driven in herds about the unclean wharves of that accursed lunar city, with the leaner ones toiling and the fatter ones taken away in crates for other needs of their polypus and amorphous masters. Now he saw where such ambiguous creatures came from, and shuddered at the thought that Lang must be known to these formless abominations from the moon. But the Shantak flew on past the fires and the stone huts and the less-than-human dancers, and soared over sterile hills of gray granite and dim wastes of rock and ice and snow. Day came, and the phosphorescence of low clouds gave place to the misty twilight of that northern world, and still the vile bird winged meaningly through the cold and silence. At times the slant-eyed man talked with his steed in a hateful and guttural language, and the Shantak would answer with tittering tones that rasped like the scratching of ground glass. All this while the land was getting higher, and finally they came to a windswept tableland which seemed the very roof of a blasted and tenantless world. There, all alone in the hush and the dusk and the cold, rose the uncouth stones of a squat, windowless building, around which a circle of crude monoliths stood. In all this arrangement, there was nothing human, and Carter surmised from old tales that he was indeed come to that most dreadful and legendary of all places, the remote and prehistoric monastery wherein dwells uncompanioned the high priest not to be described, which wears a yellow silken mask over its face and prays to the other gods and their crawling chaos, Nyarlathotep. The loathsome bird now settled to the ground, and the slant-eyed man hopped down and helped his captive alight. Of the purpose of his seizure, Carter now felt very sure, for clearly the slant-eyed merchant was an agent of the darker powers, eager to drag before his masters a mortal whose presumption had aimed at the finding of unknown Kadath and the saying of a prayer before the faces of the great ones in their onyx castle. It seemed likely that this merchant had caused his former capture by the slaves of the Moonthings and Dilathleen, and that he now meant to do what the rescuing cats had baffled, taking the victim to some dread rendezvous with monstrous Nyarlathotep, and telling with what boldness the seeking of unknown Kadath had been tried. Lang and the cold waste north of Inquinoc must be close to the other gods, and there the passes to Kadath are well guarded. The slant-eyed man was small, but the great hippocephalic bird was there to see he was obeyed. So Carter followed where he led and passed within the circle of standing rocks and into the low arched doorway of that windowless stone monastery. There were no lights inside, but the evil merchant lit a small clay lamp bearing morbid bas-reliefs and prodded his prisoner on through mazes of narrow, winding corridors. On the walls of the corridors were printed frightful scenes older than history, and in a style unknown to the archaeologists of Earth. After countless aeons, their pigments were brilliant still, for the cold and dryness of hideous Lang keep alive many primal things. Carter saw them fleetingly in the rays of that dim and moving lamp, and shuddered at the tale they told. Through those archaic frescoes Lang's annals stalked, and the horned, hoofed, and wide-mouthed almost humans danced evilly amidst forgotten cities. There were scenes of old wars wherein Lang's almost humans fought with the bloated purple spiders of the neighboring vales. And there were scenes also of the coming of the black galleys from the moon and the submission of Lang's people to the polypus and amorphous blasphemies that hopped and floundered and wriggled out of them. Those slippery, grayish-white blasphemies they worshipped as gods, nor ever complained when scores of their best and fatted males were taken away in the black galleys. The monstrous moon beasts made their camp on a jagged isle in the sea, and Carter could tell from the frescoes that this was none other than the lone, nameless rock he'd seen when sailing to Inquinoc, that gray, accursed rock which Inquinoc's seamen shun, and from which vile howlings reverberate all through the night. And in those frescoes were shown the great seaport and capital of the almost humans, proud and pillared betwixt the cliffs and the basalt wharves, and wondrous with high fanes and carven places. great gardens and columned streets let from the cliffs, and from each of the six sphinx-crowned gates to a vast central plaza. And in that plaza was a pair of winged colossal lions guarding the top of a subterranean staircase. Again and again were those huge winged lions shown, their mighty flanks of diorite glistening in the gray twilight of the day and the cloudy phosphorescence of the night. And as Carter stumbled past their frequent and repeated pictures, it came to him at last what indeed they were, and what city it was that the almost humans had ruled so anciently before the coming of the black galleys. There could be no mistake, for the legends of Dreamland are generous and profuse. Indubitably, that primal city was no less a place than storied Sarcomand, whose ruins had bleached for a million years before the first true human saw the light, and whose twin titan lions guard eternally the steps that lead down from Dreamland to the great abyss. Other views showed the gaunt gray peaks dividing Leng from Inquinoc, and the monstrous Shantak birds that build nests on the ledges halfway up, and they showed likewise the curious caves near the very topmost pinnacles, and how even the boldest of Shantaks fly screaming away from them. Carter had seen those caves when he passed over them and had noticed their likeness to the caves on Ingranik. Now he knew that the likeness was more than a chance one, for in these pictures were shown their fearsome denizens, and those bat wings, curving horns, barbed tails, prehensile paws, and rubbery bodies were not strange to him. He had met those silent, flitting, and clutching creatures before, those mindless guardians of the great abyss whom even the great ones fear, and who own not Nyarlathotep but hoary Nodens as their lord. For they were the dreaded night gaunts, who never laugh or smile because they have no faces, and who flop unendingly in the dark between the veil of Pnath and the passes to the outer world. The slant-eyed merchant had now prodded Carter into a great domed space whose walls were carved in shocking bas-reliefs, and whose center held a gaping circular pit surrounded by six malignly stained stone altars in a ring. There was no light in this vast, evil-smelling crypt, and the small lamp of the sinister merchant shone so feebly that one could grasp details only little by little. At the farther end was a high stone dais reached by five steps, and there on a golden throne sat a lumpish figure robed in yellow silk figured with red and having a yellow silken mask over its face. To this being the slant-eyed man made certain signs with his hands, and the lurker in the dark replied by raising a disgustingly carven flute of ivory and silk-covered paws and blowing certain loathsome sounds from beneath its flowing yellow mask. This colloquy went on for some time, and to Carter there was something sickeningly familiar in the sound of that flute and the stench of the malodorous place. It made him think of a frightful red-litten city and of the revolting procession that once filed through it, of that and of an awful climb through lunar countryside beyond, before the rescuing rush of Earth's friendly cats. He knew that the creature on the dais was without doubt the high priest not to be described, of which legend whispered such fiendish and abnormal possibilities. But he feared to think just what that abhorred high priest might be. Then the figured silk slipped the trifle from one of the grayish-white paws, and Carter knew what the noisome high priest was. And in that hideous second, stark fear drove him to something his reason would never have dared to attempt, for in all his shaken consciousness there was room only for one frantic will to escape from what squatted on that golden throne. He knew that hopeless labyrinths of stone lay betwixt him and the cold tableland outside, and that even on that tableland the noxious Shantak still waited. Yet in spite of all this, there was in his mind only the instant need to get away from that wriggling, silk-robed monstrosity. The slant-eyed man had set the curious lamp upon one of the high and wickedly stained altar stones by the pit, and had moved forward somewhat to talk to the high priest with his hands. Carter, hitherto wholly passive, now gave that man a terrific push with all the wild strength of fear, so that the victim toppled at once into that gaping well which rumor holds to reach down to the hellish vaults of Zin, where Gugs haunt ghasts in the dark. In almost the same second he seized the lamp from the altar and darted out into the frescoed labyrinths, racing this way and that as chance determined, and trying not to think of the stealthy padding of shapeless paws on the stones behind him, or of the silent wrigglings and crawlings which must be going on back there in lightless corridors. After a few minutes he regretted his thoughtless haste, and wished he'd tried to follow backwards the frescoes he'd passed on the way in. True, they were so confused and duplicated that they could not have done him much good, but he wished nonetheless he'd made the attempt. Those he now saw were even more horrible than those he'd seen then, and he knew he was not in the corridors leading outside. In time he became quite sure he was not followed and slackened his pace somewhat, but scarce had he breathed in half relief when a new peril beset him. His lamp was waning, and he would soon be in pitch blackness with no means of sight or guidance. When the light was all gone, he groped slowly in the dark and prayed to the great ones for such help as they might afford. At times he felt the stone floor sloping up or down, and once he stumbled over a step for which no reason seemed to exist. The farther he went, the damper it seemed to be, and when he was able to feel a junction or the mouth of a side passage, he always chose the way which sloped downward the least. He believed, though, that his general course was down, and the vault-like smell and incrustations on the greasy walls and floor alike warned him he was burrowing deep in Lang's unwholesome tableland. But there was not any warning of the thing which came at last, only the thing itself with its terror and shock and breathtaking chaos. One moment he was groping slowly over the slippery floor of an almost level place, and the next he was shooting dizzily downward in the dark through a burrow which must have been well nigh vertical. Of the length of that hideous sliding he could never be sure, but it seemed to take hours of delirious nausea and ecstatic frenzy. Then he realized he was still, with the phosphorescent clouds of a northern night shining sickly above him. All around were crumbling walls and broken columns, and the pavement on which he lay was pierced by straggling grass and wrenched asunder by frequent shrubs and roots. Behind him a basalt cliff rose topless and perpendicular, its dark side sculptured into repellent scenes and pierced by an arched and carven entrance to the inner blackness out of which he'd come. Ahead stretched double rows of pillars and the fragments and pedestals of pillars that spoke of a broad and bygone street. And from the urns and basins along the way he knew it had been a great street of gardens. Far off at its end the pillars spread to mark a vast round plaza. And in that open circle there loomed gigantic under the lurid night clouds a pair of monstrous things. Huge winged lions of diorite they were, with blackness and shadow between them. Full 20 feet they reared their grotesque and unbroken heads and snarled derisive on the ruins around them. And Carter knew right well what they must be, for legend tells of only one such twain. They were the changeless guardians of the great abyss, and these dark ruins were in truth primordial Sarcomand. Carter's first act was to close and barricade the archway and the cliff with fallen blocks and odd debris that lay around. He wished no follower from Leng's hateful monastery, for along the way ahead would lurk enough of other dangers. Of how to get from Sarcomand to the peopled parts of Dreamland he knew nothing at all, nor could he gain much by descending to the grottos of the ghouls, since he knew they were no better informed than he. The three ghouls which had helped him through the city of Gugs to the outer world had not known how to reach Sarcomand in their journey back, but had planned to ask old traders in Dilathleen. He did not like to think of going again to the subterranean world of Gugs and risking once more that hellish tower of Koth with its cyclopean steps leading to the enchanted wood. Yet he felt he might have to try this course if all else failed. Over Leng's plateau, past the lone monastery, he dared not go unaided, for the high priest's emissaries must be many, while at the journey's end there would no doubt be the Shantaks and perhaps other things to deal with. If he could get a boat, he might sail back to Inquinoc past the jagged and hideous rock in the sea, for the primal frescoes in the monastery labyrinth had shown that this frightful place lies not far from Sarcomand's basalt keys. But to find a boat in this aeon deserted city was no probable thing, and it did not appear likely that he could ever make one. Such were the thoughts of Randolph Carter when a new impression began beating upon his mind. All this while there had stretched before him the great corpse-like width of fabled Sarcomand with its black broken pillars and crumbling sphinx-crowned gates and titan stones and monstrous winged lions against the sickly glow of those luminous night clouds. Now he saw far ahead and on the right a glow that no clouds could account for, and knew he was not alone in the silence of that dead city. The glow rose and fell fitfully, flickering with a greenish tinge which did not reassure the watcher, and when he crept closer down the littered street and through some narrow gaps between tumbled walls, he perceived that it was a campfire near the wharves, with many vague forms clustered darkly around it, and a lethal odor hanging heavily over all. Beyond was the oily lapping of the harbor water with a great ship riding at anchor, and Carter paused in stark terror when he saw that the ship was indeed one of the dreaded black galleys from the moon. Then, just as he was about to creep back from that detestable flame, he saw a stirring among the vague dark forms and heard a peculiar and unmistakable sound. It was the frightened meeping of a ghoul, and in a moment it had swelled to a veritable chorus of anguish. Secure as he was in the shadow of monstrous ruins, Carter allowed his curiosity to conquer his fear and crept forward again instead of retreating. Once in crossing an open street, he wriggled worm-like on his stomach, and in another place he had to rise to his feet to avoid making a noise among heaps of fallen marble. But he always succeeded in avoiding discovery, so that in a short time he'd found a spot behind a Titan pillar where he could watch the whole green-lit scene of action. There, around a hideous fire fed by the obnoxious stems of lunar fungi, there squatted a stinking circle of the toad-like moon beasts and their almost human slaves. Some of these slaves were heating curious iron spears in the leaping flames, and at intervals applying their white-hot points to three tightly trussed prisoners that lay writhing before the leaders of the party. From the motions of their tentacles, Carter could see that the blunt-snouted moon beasts were enjoying the spectacle hugely, and vast was his horror when he suddenly recognized a frantic meeping and knew that the tortured ghouls were none other than the faithful trio which had guided him safely from the abyss and had thereafter set out from the enchanted wood to find Sarkamand and the gate to their native deeps. The number of malodorous moon beasts about that greenish fire was very great, and Carter saw that he could do nothing now to save his former allies. Of how the ghouls had been captured, he could not guess, but fancied that the great hoat-like blasphemies had heard them inquire in Delathleen concerning the way to Sarkamand, and had not wished them to approach so closely the hateful plateau of Leng and the High Priest not to be described. For a moment he pondered on what he ought to do, and recalled how near he was to the gate of the ghoul's black kingdom. Clearly it was wisest to creep east to the Plaza of Twin Lions and descend at once to the gulf, where assuredly he would meet no horrors worse than those above, and where he might soon find ghouls eager to rescue their brethren and perhaps to wipe out the moon beast from the Black Galley. It occurred to him that the portal, like other gates to the abyss, might be guarded by flocks of night gaunts. But he did not fear these faceless creatures now. He had learned that they're bound by solemn treaties with the ghouls, and the ghoul which was Pikmin had taught him how to glibber a password they understood.